The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, welcome back to our second evening on the 6-week introductory course in mindfulness. And if you were new last week, welcome. And hopefully, I think that what I say today will bring you along as well. If you're new, one of the things I did say last week is that this online course, that this course that I teach is also online, meaning that the previous 6-week introductory courses were recorded and then put up on our website. And there's a corner of our website called Audio Dharma. And so if you miss a class, like if you missed last week, the first week, you can get a version of it there online. So this is an introductory course in mindfulness, and my hope is that you'll learn something about some useful options of how to use your attention, rather than taking attention as something that is obvious, something that you don't have to give any thought about. It's just kind of like, you know, they say the fish doesn't see the water it swims in. People often don't see the attention, the awareness that they swim in, that we live in. And by bringing attention, to how we use attention, how we direct attention, we can tap into some of the power and strength and possibilities that are inherent in intention for helping us live a wiser, more useful and peaceful life. So a lot of what we do here is just cultivation, developing attention, and learning how to pay attention to areas of our life which are useful to pay attention to. Last week I talked about, in terms of meditation practice, I talked about having a good posture for meditation and then using the breath as a focal point for attention. The breath is often used for people to help calm down. The people who get tense, sometimes friends or therapists say, just breathe deeply and then it'll calm you down. For most people, not everyone, most people, the breath is a calming influence. And there's a wonderful reciprocal relationship between our emotional life, our psychological life, and our breathing, and also our physical life. And so the more oxygen we need, the more we breathe in a certain way. So if we're geared up for flight, fear and flight, the breathing will gear itself up to respond accordingly. So fear can have a big effect on our breathing. Anger can have a big effect on our breathing. Joy can affect our breathing. Pretty much any emotion at all can affect how we breathe, what muscles contract and tight, and how deep and shallow the breath is. So it's a very strong relationship. As we tune into the breath, we start being aware, we start kind of regulating the breath a little bit and having a little more easeful breath, relaxed breath. And that focus on the breath then tends to be calming and settling. The most important thing for mindfulness practice is in the way in which the calming of the mind helps us then to see more clearly what's going on. If the mind is agitated, or the mind is preoccupied and thinking about things all the time, it can't really see what's right here in front of us, what's going on right here. And so it's a training, and they're usually focusing on the breath, coming back to the breath, wandering off and coming back. That constant coming back is begins to kind of break up the habit of the mind always chasing after whatever preoccupies it, whatever concerns are. And so slowly the mind begins to settle down, quiet down. And a mind that's quiet and centered is one that's much more productive for the purposes of using our attention. You can use attention much better if you have it available. And you don't have it available if you're constantly flitting off in this thought and this concern and that concern we have. So the breath is often used as the beginning point for mindfulness meditation. But it's not the end of meditation. It's the foundation, but from there we branch out, we expand outwards. So eventually we learn how to bring a careful attention, a useful attention, to whatever's going on in our human experience. That is, the whole range of our human experience can be included in the field of mindfulness in such a way that the attention, the awareness we bring, is one which frees us from reactivity, frees us from being locked on or reactive or contracted or resistant or fearful of whatever it is we're paying attention to, that we can be present for the experience with some high quality, balanced, equanimous, calm attention So again, we can see it more clearly. And there it gives a possibility for, in Buddhist language, you talk about wisdom or insight, being able to see in a deeper way. So we started with the breath. And today, we're going to go further on and talk about mindfulness of the body. And when I was a pretty young man, I guess he couldn't be a younger man, to still be a man, I was already interested in Buddhism, and I was reading books about Buddhism. And it seemed like a wonderful philosophy. And it seemed kind of, from some of the books I read, it seemed like primarily it was a philosophy. And then I went to Buddhist meditation centers and monasteries and started practicing. And one of the surprises was that the actual people who practiced it in the monasteries, the philosophy wasn't that important. The philosophy wasn't that central. What was really central was what you did with your body. And I learned that a big part of at least classic Buddhist training involves becoming embodied, becoming present for your life through your body. It's not a heady thing, Buddhism, even though you can read lots of books in Buddhism, you can get a PhD in Buddhism, I know, and which is usually taken to be a pretty heady thing. But that Buddhism itself is a lot about dropping down from the head, in a sense, and really learning to awaken a heightened sensitivity of our life, of ourselves, of what goes on in our body. And there's a tremendous amount of intelligence, tremendous amount of sensitivity, useful sensitivity, that we can have towards our life, towards our emotions, towards our friends, towards everything, if we're aware of things through the vehicle of our bodily senses. It's very different information we get than the information we get when we understand things through the avenue of our thoughts, our ideas that we might have. And so it's very embodied, the practice of Buddhism, and mindfulness in particular, so much so that sometimes I joke that it's the Pali word that we translated into English as mindfulness probably should have been called bodyfulness. However, that also kind of is skewed, because if we only emphasize the body, then we don't emphasize how important the mind is in all this as well. And in fact, Buddhism does not make a sharp dichotomy or duality between the mind and body in the way that some Western currents of thought have done, or sometimes it's a very sharp divide. And so it's very integrated, and mindfulness practice mediates these two worlds, or integrates these two worlds. Some people need to cultivate a greater capacity to be aware through their body, and some people need to have a heightened capacity to be aware in a useful way through their mind. People don't know what's going on there very much. And mindfulness itself involves a combination of both. Today, the subject is mindfulness of the body, and how that kind of expands out from that of the breath. And I'd like to begin with a little story, a report about a dissertation that was written some years ago at the university up here, Saybrook College up in San Francisco. And a philosopher, I don't know what she was getting a degree in, but she went and studied high school graduates. In a lot of different high schools all around, and gave the high school graduates tests for testing for ethical IQ. Pretty good, huh? Do you know I have an ethical IQ? And my EQ, how's your EQ doing these days? Luckily, EQ can be improved dramatically. IQ, they say, is kind of stable, right? But EQ, that's really variable. So that's a good news. But anyway, so ethical IQ. And they found that different kinds of high schools with different pedagogy and all that. And they found that across the board, there was one kind of pedagogy, one kind of school, where the students there who graduated from high school had an ethical IQ of equivalent to a philosophy major in ethics, which supposedly they have high ethical IQs. And so they were kind of surprised, but there was one exception. And there was a high school in Hawaii where also they had this high IQ, but that high school didn't have this pedagogy, that way of teaching. So they went and studied. What was going on with these people in Hawaii? They were the exception of these high. And they found out that that high school, a lot of the students who came into that high school came from a grade school that had that pedagogy. And so there was something about in grade school, they thought, what happens to those kids in grade school that allows them to have such a high ethical intelligence when they get older? And no one knows for sure, but the pedagogy, the people in that system of schooling themselves, they say, oh, we know why. And that is, when the kids are young, we cultivate in them a high mindfulness of the body. They become highly aware, sensitive to their world around them through their body. They know what they're going on in their body. They have this bodily intelligence, bodily awareness. They're aware of their environment very much through their body. We cultivate heightened sensitivity. We do a lot of things with the body. We teach math through the body. They do this kind of, they move around the classroom. They don't just sit at the desk doing problems. They move around the classroom and they do all these kind of math dances to get their math, so they learn how to do through their body. There's a whole bunch of ways in which this pedagogy uses the body a lot. So what do you think of that? Your body, you know, is a useful vehicle. It's very important. Many people don't do much to cultivate the awareness in their body, their sensitivity to their body. There are some people who are so heady because of their work. They're just always doing some work that involves a lot of thinking. And sometimes the people get disconnected over many, many years of just kind of working at a keyboard and thinking, whatever. Some people would rather not be in their body, because if you're in your body, connected to your body, it means you have to feel your emotions a lot more. And some people would rather not feel their emotions, because sometimes they're so challenging, so difficult. And so there's a way in which people disconnect or kind of repress or shut off that part of their body. I meet people who say that they're not really aware of what goes on physically in their body, really, you know, much below their neck or below their waist. And sometimes it has to do with trauma, that people have very strong trauma sometimes that they say, please, you know, the body kind of shuts down that part, because if they're aware in that part of the body, they become aware of those feelings that are come out through that part of the body. Some people get messages from their family, from their society, from their religion, that the body is not to be respected, body is not to be listened to, that the body is to be denied or shut down, and it has no intelligence. And so that's another reason people don't pay attention. Some people feel the body is kind of disgusting. So Buddhist meditation practice is actually an antidote to all that, because part of it is, in Buddhism, we don't celebrate the body like some people want to do, but we have this middle way, which is very important in Buddhism, which is to allow for the sensitivity of the body to be fully there. And as the body, as we become more connected to our body, then we actually develop greater understanding, greater insight into what's going on, and also greater self-control. A greater ability not to let our emotions and feelings and reactivity get the upper hand. And we actually can be much more choiceful about what we say in different situations, or how we act in different situations, and how we relate to what's going on. It gives a lot of freedom. Does that make some sense? And then a story. So part of it is developing greater capacity, greater awareness of the body. But there's also a greater awareness of what goes on in the mind. And without a greater understanding of the mind and how the mind works, it's hard to develop awareness, and it's hard to develop concentration and stillness. So I want to teach you something about the mind, and then we'll do some meditation on all this. And this is a lesson I learned a long time ago when I was teaching a retreat, meditation retreat, in November, with a bunch of meditation teachers. They were colleagues. We were all teaching together. And I think three of them were 49ers fans. And at a time, during football season, when the 49ers, back then when the 49ers were doing really well, so it was kind of, you know, pretty cool to be a 49er fan. So you really wanted to watch the games back then when they're winning, right? Fair weather fans, they were. And so I didn't know much about football, but wasn't particularly interested, but I was with them, and so we were in the teacher's lounge during a break, and they were watching the football game. And so we were all watching, you know, guys watching football game. They happened to be Buddhist meditation teachers. The commercial came on, and the guy who had the remote pushed the mute, which I think is a very sensible thing to do. And so then we talked. But then the commercials ended and the game started. And the guy who had the remote did not unmute the television. And since he was a mindfulness teacher, we stopped talking, we started looking at the television. And since he was a mindfulness teacher, you know, I figured he was pretty mindful. He knew that there was no sound coming out of the TV. There was no need for me to nudge him and, you know, tell him, "Hey, you know, push the button." And one of the qualities of mindfulness practice is curiosity, is interest. Rather than reacting to something, for or against something, attitude is, "What is this?" So, rather than for or against, "What is this?" Isn't that nice? So I thought, what is this? What's going on here? What's this like? So we watched this game without any sound. And it was very interesting because you see these guys line up, face each other, and they fall down. you know, it's kind of nice. And you kind of know, so you kind of see what's going on. I kind of knew the basics of the line. Every once in a while, some guy would somehow be able to get away from that, all those pile of people. And he was running down the field, crossing these lines. And you felt kind of good about him. You know, good, he's making it. You know, it's nice. And you know where he's going. And he knows where he's going. And then you see some person come out from left field or someplace. I guess they don't have left field in baseball, football, but, you know, from someplace. And they tackle him, he falls down, that's too bad. And, you know, kind of know what's going on. So that was nice. And then after a while, my friend unmuted the television, and we heard the sound. And I was really impressed by the difference between without the sound and with the sound. And with the sound, there was a commentator who was kind of talking the game up. And I think that probably the job descriptions of these sportscasters to get the audience into the game and excited and involved. And in fact, it wasn't just, "Oh, the guy, look at that, it's nice, the guy's making across those lines." It was like, "Wow, you know, this is exciting." And I would find myself wanting to edge of my seat and wanting to stand sometimes, you know. It was so much more involved and caught up in the game, which was fun. But it wasn't because of the game. It was because of the commentator that was pulling me in. It's kind of like mood music in the movies. You know, it's just a pastoral, beautiful trail going in the woods. It's very idyllic looking until you hear that ominous music and your hair stands up. You know, it's just a path in the woods, you know, that's all it is. But then the music, you know, or canned laughter, it's not funny. But then, you know, canned laughter kind of pulls you in. You think it's funny. So there's ways in which there's added information, added commentary to our experience, which adds something which is not inherent in what's going on. And we have commentators in our minds. And we often will see the experience through the filter of our commentator, good and bad, and what it is like for me. And we don't necessarily see it as separate from the real experience. We see it's part of it. We believe it. It's so integrated in everything that it's all part and parcel of it. Like we're watching the football game, the commentator is all part and parcel of it. But it's possible to, in a sense, to push the mute button and then not have all that interference or all that commentary, be able to see our experience directly for what it is. So, you could sit down to meditate and you have a little itch on your cheek. It's not so uncommon for human beings to have itches. So a little, you know, itch on your cheek. So that's, you know, it's an itch. But then the commentary starts up. "Oh no, an itch. I bet this is skin cancer. And I was too much in the sun as a child. And my parents didn't really love me because they didn't really take care of me. I didn't put enough suntan lotion on, and those parents and suntan lotion. But suntan lotion itself is probably bad. It probably has all the stuff in it you shouldn't have anyway. And I really need to write to my senator." And off the commentator goes, you know, and pretty soon we're not even involved with the itch. We're off someplace, you know, writing letters and complaining about the administration. The commentator has a dramatic life of its own that really can lead us all kinds of different ways. A very important part of mindfulness practice is being able to see the difference between the experience we're having and the commentary. So if I'm sitting meditating and my mind wanders off, I notice that and I come back. That's one thing. We sit and meditate, the mind wanders off, And the commentator says, I'm a lousy meditator. I can't do this. I wonder if there's some different spiritual practice for me. Maybe Sufi dancing would be better for me. And off we get pulled into that world of commentary. And there could be a wide range of commentary. It could all be about you, how terrible we are. It could be, you could maybe manage to follow three breaths in a row. Then the commentary is how great you are. You're the next solution to the spiritual needs of humanity. Isn't this great? And, it's all kinds of things. We get pulled in. And some of the way things we get pulled into are in character of the kind of primary concerns that drive us. Maybe it's all about yourself. Maybe you can't follow your breath very well. And so it's all about how you are in relationship to other people. I bet the other people here at IMC, they must be doing really well. They probably got up to 9 breaths. And I couldn't even get to 3. And, they're so much better than me. And I'll sneak out of here before anybody notices that I'm an embarrassment to breath meditation. So some of these commentaries can be okay, and some of them are very, very painful. They really are depressing, kind of drain us and kind of demoralize us and have a big effect on us. A very important part of this practice here is to learn to see the difference between the experience we have and the commentary we make to it. And the reason why that's important is so we don't necessarily believe the commentary, we don't get involved in it. We can question it, maybe it's not so valid, the commentary. But even more important, so that we can leave the commentary alone. Don't pick it up. And let the attention stay present for the direct experience, for what's actually happening. If the task at hand is to stay with the breathing, then notice when the commentary comes in, and notice the commentary is not the breathing, and then be willing to stay with the breath. Stay involved with this breathing. Don't get pulled away. And if you really see the distinction between the two, then you're much more likely to be successful at doing meditation. If you don't see that distinction, which is hard, it's a hard distinction to really see, then it's so easy to get pulled into the world of thinking and commentary and judging and criticism and all that. And that is, and when you do that, you more often than not, we're no longer involved, or how to say it, we're no longer in control of our attention, of our awareness. We're no longer monitoring and really using it in a useful way. When we direct it to our breath, then we're in charge. If we get pulled into thinking about whatever, then something else is in charge. And so we're slowly beginning to take charge of our attention, how our attention gets used. Eventually, even the idea of taking charge is seen as being extra. But that comes in its own time. Does this make sense to you? So with that, let's do a... I'll do a guided meditation, and this will be kind of an introduction to the instructions we have about the body. Some of you who are new to all this sitting stuff might actually want to stand for a moment before we do this meditation. So please, if you want to stand and stretch, and maybe the people on the floor, if you can come forward a little bit, then maybe there's more space in the back for other people who want to sit on cushions on the floor. And if there are more people who want to sit on cushions, and if we ran out on the shelves out there, there are these half moon cushions in the cabinet just to the right as you go out. The first cabinet, there's a whole stack of them. And there are benches under the stage by the little steps going up to the stage in the far end. Oh, there's a whole line for the bathroom now. Well, maybe then we should take some questions. Any questions, anybody like what I said so far? Yes, please.
The word pedagogy.
Pedagogy. Pedagogy means a theory of teaching. You know, the approach to teaching that people have. I'm sorry. Yes.
Can I use the microphone? Sure. So I have a question from last week. So I drive a lot for work, and I was wondering how I can be more mindful as I'm driving.
Oh, the world would love that. I think it was this morning I read that 28% of car accidents now are because of people are on the cell phone or texting when they drive.
I definitely don't do that.
No, I'm saying you did, but oh. But the world is happy with my phone. It helps if you turn off the radio. It helps if you don't listen to talk to the phone. It helps if you have both hands on the steering wheel. So you're kind of, because mindfulness is supported by bringing your full being into whatever you're doing. So if you have both hands on the steering wheel, you're more fully engaged in what you're doing. You're not so casual. Part of you is involved, part of you not. And then you would have just enough awareness of your mind to notice how often your mind wanders away and how often you're really here in a quality way for the road, for the traffic, what goes on. And you're really here kind of with the experience of driving itself, looking around, checking the rearview mirror. Kind of, it often helps to have your eyes move a lot when you drive, I find. Because each time you move your eyes a little bit, it can be small little movements. It's a little a new kind of attention you're bringing. And some people find it useful to have a little mental note that says driving, just to remind you, rather than, you know, thinking about work or this or that, driving, just to remind you, just be there driving. And I find that when I drive that way, I can arrive my destination much more relaxed than if I'm listening to the radio. Even though I can feel, or used to feel, that there was this pull to the radio to turn it on, variety of kind of addictions and pulls. And also there's feeling with the radio, there was this pleasure in listening to the music or whatever on the radio. And that pleasure seemed so innocent, seemed so right. And in the moment, it was like, you know, that was the best pleasure I could get, you know, just driving the music. But what I've learned is that that listening to music would not get me as relaxed as driving mindfully, quietly. And even though the first moments of being mindful wasn't as pleasant, the cumulative effect of that kind of space and time was, you know, much more pleasant and settled. And there are times when it actually feels, not exactly like meditation, but it feels very peaceful and very enjoyable to just drive, and especially if there's not a lot of stop and go. Yeah, that's... Yes?
What kind of body awareness were they actually teaching in Hawaii to those, were they children?
Yeah, I mean, it was a whole range of things. There was dance they were teaching the kids, a variety of dance. There was physical exercise. There was a lot of hand work that the kids did. There was these math exercises that involved moving around the classroom, throwing bean bags back and forth. There was a lot of different things they were doing. Yes?
I'm into trail running. Here's a microphone that you can use. I'm into trail running, and it seems to kind of lend itself to meditation.
Yes.
Automatically aware of your breathing.
Uh-huh.
Is that, am I on the right track with that?
Well, there's a lot. Mindfulness can be cultivated in any activity at all. There are times that I really enjoy getting into being in the kitchen and cooking and cleaning and up and all that, because I'm really there, and that's all I'm doing. And my mind has a tendency to think about something else, or... One of the things that short circuits our attempts to be mindful is trying to get through something quickly, so we can get on to more important things. To really cultivate strong mindfulness, you want to be it for doing one thing. Just be there for that thing when you're doing it. So there's many things you can do that in. And so some athletic things, and some things which are repetitive in nature, are particularly useful because it helps to kind of simplify the world, and the repetition pulls us in and keeps us going. And something like trail running, you really have to be there and pay attention. You know, if you think about the wrong thing, you'll step on the
snake.
And so it's a great thing. It's a great thing to do. There is something, though, a big difference between... the thing about that is that you're kind of developing concentration, attention, and all these things. It's a very... but it's kind of a prop. I remember seeing a movie many years ago of a person who said, I used to go motorcycle racing in the weekends to reduce my stress. But then I had kids, and I didn't have time to do that. So what I do now is I get up early in the morning, and I sneak into high rises being built, and climb to the top floor with a little backpack that has a paraglide kind of parachute in the back. And I jump off, you know, at dusk, before anybody's up and before I get caught. And so there's a getaway car down in the streets. And I fly down, you know, through the streets and land on the street. And it only takes a couple of minutes or a few seconds or whatever. And by the time I get to the bottom, my mind is cleared out. I'm really clear and present. And so it's a lot more efficient than the motorcycle racing. But that's kind of like using a prop, you know. It's kind of like a drug almost. And what we're trying to do here with mindfulness is to develop a natural capacity of attention and awareness that doesn't rely on the extra kind of caffeine or oomph of some activity. So on one hand, it's really great to do what you're doing. On the other hand, don't use that as an excuse not to cultivate mindfulness elsewhere. And part of the virtue of meditation practice, and now you all run away when I say this, part of the virtue of meditation practice is, in a very conventional point of view, it's pretty boring. Not much is going on. There's not a lot of excitement, usually, you know, unless you get, once you get, concentration gets really strong, it gets pretty exciting. It's pretty awesome what can happen. But ordinarily, it's kind of like, you know, sit down and, you know, you're not getting stimulated by television or friends or work, or you're not, no one's chasing you and the police aren't chasing you or anything. Nothing really exciting going on, it's just you. And so you get to bring mindfulness and discover who you are when there's nothing extra being added. And you get to see all the movements of the mind, the fears, the concerns, the desires and all that, and you get to face yourself in a much more direct way. And then you get to work through that and work through something in a deep way. If you use running to kind of burst your way through it all, you don't see it, you don't work with it. Make sense? Okay, let's do some meditation, there'll be a chance. It's okay? Okay, so take a comfortable but alert posture. And the mindfulness practice begins with mindfulness of posture. So it's also part of a way of being in the body. So feel your body. And then, before we do anything else, check into your body. Take stock. Close your eyes and just feel the experience of your body. And how is your body now? How is it energetically? Is it comfortable, uncomfortable? Tense, relaxed? Are some parts of your body more active or aware or energized than other parts? And as you experience your body, do you have any commentary about that? Any judgments or ideas And if you do, can you gently let go of them or put them aside enough and experience your body in a very simple way, just as it is, as if it's okay to have the body be the way it is right now? And then within the body, see if you can take now a few long, slow, deep breaths. So that as you breathe in deeply, you feel your torso expand and stretch. Taking a deep breath in, and as you exhale, let your breathing relax. And let your body relax. Soften your shoulders. Maybe it's possible to soften your belly. And then let your breathing return to normal. And again, become aware of your body. Stay connected to your body. And look around your body to see if there's any easy places that you can soften or relax. So maybe the forehead and eyes can be softened. Perhaps the jaws can be relaxed a little bit. Some people find it helpful to let the mouth kind of drop open and then let the teeth float back together gently. perhaps as you exhale, soften the shoulder and the shoulder blade area. And again, it can be useful to soften the belly. Now within the body, as part of your bodily experience, become aware of how your body experiences breathing. And notice where you experience breathing, where your body experiences breathing most clearly. Maybe in the belly, maybe the chest, maybe the nostrils. Or maybe it's the whole, all those places together, kind of a global awareness of breathing. And wherever you feel it clearest, let that be your home base. And for the next little while, stay there with awareness. Just be aware of the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. When the mind wanders away, gently bring it back, and bring it back as often as you need. Trying not to get involved in any commentary about it, or commentary about something else. There might be commentary, but let it float away. Let your attention, your precious attention, be directed to feel and sense and be present for the rhythm of breathing in and out. To help you stay with the breathing, very, very gently, softly in the mind, say the words in for in-breath, out for the out-breath, or rising as the chest and belly rise, and falling as it falls. Just nudge to stay there, each breath. No need for commentary at all of anything. Allow yourself to experience your breathing the way it is. Get relaxed about how it is. Seeing if you can hang in there to experience a series of breaths in a row. And now, let go of paying attention to breathing. And instead, scan through your body and see if you can notice what the strongest sensation is in your body. And if there's several that are of equal strength, just choose one. And bring your attention to really look at or feel the strongest sensation that you have in the body. It can be pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't matter. And see if you can experiment a little bit and see if you can bring an attention to that strong sensation that is not for or against it, not reactive to it. It's not caught up in commentary about it. That in a sense just allows it to be there as it is. Has permission to be there, and your job is to feel it carefully, like you're getting to know it for the first time. And notice what happens to that sensation, that experience, as you're present for it, as you're paying attention to it. Does it get stronger or weaker? Larger, smaller. If it happens to disappear or get weak, then you might look for a different sensation that's the next strongest and bring your attention to that. And can you notice how easy it is to stay present in a simple way for your bodily sensations? Or how difficult it is because you get pulled off into your reactions, your concerns, your feelings about it, your relationship to it. And for now, see if you can just be really simple. Come back to the simplicity of just feeling the strongest sensations in and of itself. See if you can put aside your reactions in favor of just feeling it, sensing it, curious about it. And if it makes sense to you, see if you can go inside the strong sensation. It doesn't have to be that strong, but whatever happens to be the strongest. See if you can go inside of it, as if awareness can go inside and feel it from the inside, as opposed to watching it from a distance. Sensing it more fully. And then, letting go of this way of doing it, come back again now to your breathing. Re-establish a connection to the breath. And notice where the home base is again, where the breath is clearest. Might not be that clear, but where it's clearest. And then as if you can get inside the sensations, the experience, let your awareness be inside of it. So you're not so much watching, but you're really sensing in the inside the movement of breathing, the pressure, the tautness, the release of it, the relaxation, the tightening, the letting go. And then in the last couple of minutes of this sitting, continue being with your breathing. But if there's any sensations in your body that are more compelling than your breathing, stop paying attention to your breathing, but instead pay attention to those compelling sensations. Being very simple, just being present, maybe naming them. Very giving simple kind of name of recognition. Tightness, burning, pressure. Just to help you stay there. Nothing has to happen, except that's a place where you're gathering together your attention, a place where you're bringing your attention to focus on something and get to know it. And if nothing else is compelling, stay with your breathing. and then to end the sitting. And take a few, two or three deep breaths again, feeling connected to your body more fully, getting ready to open your eyes. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. After, in the time of the Buddha had an attendant named Ananda who accompanied him for many, many years. And after the Buddha died, a man came to Ananda and said to him, now that your good spiritual friend, your teacher is gone, who's going to be your friend? Who's going to be your teacher now? And Ananda said, now mindfulness of my body will be my teacher. That's a pretty impressive statement, that your body becomes your teacher. And in Buddhism, we believe that there's so much information, so much learning, so much guidance that can come from being in touch with your body, that it can be a wonderful teacher for us if we learn how to be present for it. Now, there are some schools of mindfulness meditation where developing a heightened mindfulness awareness of our body is done very explicitly and very systematically, where it's called using a body scan. Some people have done it. You start at the top of your head, and you systematically go through and experience the different parts of your body. And it works very well for people who are sometimes cut off from parts of their body, because you systematically go through that part and get to know it, familiar with it, and you kind of waken it up. In our tradition of mindfulness, we generally don't teach this. Sometimes we do, but it's not really a big thing for what we do. But rather, we do something that's a little bit more organic, perhaps. And that is that we stay with the breath, and try to develop concentration and composure and presence with the breathing until something else becomes more compelling, more predominant, stronger than our ability to stay with the breath. And at that time, and we let go of the breath and we bring our attention to that other compelling experience, sensation. If we don't, if there's something compelling and you're trying to stay with the breath, then there's a tension between you're trying to stay with the breath and something else is asking for attention. So we don't want that tension, so we just let go of the breath and bring our attention to this other thing and pay attention to it. And then over time, if you sit in our system, you focus on the breath, and over time, different places in your body will speak up, say, bring your attention over here. And sometimes it's because structurally you're uncomfortable, you're sitting not so well. But sometimes there's all this other stuff that it goes on there in our body. Our body holds a lot of holds a lot of our life. You know, if we're tense around something and the muscles tense up, it's not just simply that the muscles are tense, but it's somehow manifesting our fear. And so if we go into those muscles, and, you know, because they're tight and they hurt, we're also meeting our fear and working with that. And so at some point, as we get more and more quiet in meditation, the loudest thing in our system reveals itself. And so at some point, you know, it might be the shoulders, or it might be the belly, or it might be different things. Some of the holding patterns in our body are ancient, come from, you know, long, long ago they got set in place. Some just came from today. And so slowly, so in this organic way, different parts of our body speak up and ask for attention. And so the training is then we bring our attention to there. So whereas one system is systematic, ours is not systematic, but over time, everything gets covered. It gets included because it's like awareness wants to, it's like awareness, water wants to go out all everywhere, right? It just kind of all the holes, it wants to flow out. Awareness wants to flow out freely throughout our body, everywhere. And so if any place is shut down or cut off, then awareness will push against that at some point and say, pay attention here. And so everything gets covered eventually in a more organic way rather than systematically in its own time. And in our tradition, we feel part of the wisdom of that, or part of the idea is that the body, or body-mind, has a kind of wisdom to know when the right time is for us to pay attention to something. And so rather than imposing in a schedule, you know, do it systematically, we just wait until the inner wisdom knows. So there might be something difficult that we have to face. Maybe there is some deep fear that we have had from childhood. And maybe we don't have to face it too quickly. But eventually, we develop enough stability and composure and strength of mindfulness that you're ready to open up to that. And that's when that part shows itself. So, I don't know. So what we do in this practice is when the breath is no longer the most compelling thing, something else is more compelling, we leave the breath and bring our attention to there. To keep it kind of simple for this week, right now we're just talking about the body. So if there's a strong sensation in the body that arises, that's more compelling with the breath, then we let go of this in the breathing and we bring our attention, just place it there, gently in that part of your body. If you have a headache, you bring your attention to your head. If you have an ache in your knee, you bring it and place your attention in your knee. If you feel a lot of warmth and pleasant sensations bubbling up through your chest or in your cheeks or somewhere, you bring your attention there and feel that. Whatever it is, you feel it there. And you don't have to be, and we're not in resistance with it. We're not letting it be, feel, we're not keeping an idea that, oh, these things are distracting me from my breath and my meditation. They become the meditation. So if you feel uncomfortable, the kind of obvious thing many people feel, oh, if I wasn't uncomfortable, then I could meditate. If I wasn't uncomfortable, then I could really do this. This discomfort is distracting me from my meditation. But actually, we don't have that attitude here in this what we do. Rather than letting it be a distraction, it becomes the meditation. So we turn the attention, okay, to the knee and feel the knee, to the head and feel the head. Wherever the strong sensation is, and hold it and feel it. With some curiosity, some interest, what is this? And there's two things to notice. There's to notice the thing in and of itself, and to also notice your relationship to it. Is there a lot of commentary and ideas and stories? You're making stories about the itch, and you know, you're writing letters to Obama now about suntan lotion, and you know, or are you just, can you be very simply, just feel that itch just in and of itself? Or, you know, and you feel the impatience around the itch, you feel the urge to scratch. Or can you stay with the itch itself, just feel it and be with it. What we're doing then is cultivating, strengthening or developing the capacity to stay present for something in and of itself rather than being pulled into the world of reactivity and commentary and judgments about it. It's a hugely significant thing. You'll develop a tremendous amount of personal power and strength if you have the ability not to get pulled into your reactivity and simply be present for what something is. You'll develop equanimity and calm, and it'll increase the range of your options about how you can respond. If you have the ability to be still and present for something and not be pulled into reactivity, then you have a gap, a pause, where you can kind of say, oh, what's the wise thing to do here? Someone irritates you. So, okay, so you bring your attention to the irritation, you feel that, and the whole situation, and you learn how to be there without being reactive or caught up or believing the irritation, just the irritation. Then you have some choice, you know, do I say something? Do I not say anything? How do I deal with this irritating person? That's a lot better approach than just punching him out. You know, so what did I do, you know? Or yelling at him, or, you know, saying something nasty. And afterwards regretting what we said. So to learn the ability to be present allows for much greater wisdom, understanding, sensitivity to the situation, and then we can hopefully respond in a more useful way. So I'd like to ask some of you, what happened in this meditation when I asked you to bring your attention to the most compelling sensation in your body, most strongest sensation in your body? What happened to your meditation? Wait for the mic.
It immediately began to fade. I was feeling a tightness, like almost like a muscle tightness in my right side of my back. And when I paid attention to it, and this happened last week as well, it was the same place. When I paid attention to it, it faded. When you said, if that's gone, pay attention to something else, and I began to kind of look around and see if there was something else, it came back. So I just stayed there.
Great.
And it really worked.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have the experience that what you paid attention to faded away as you brought attention to it?
I had a similar but opposite reaction. I also had a knot on my back and kind of painful, but it intensified, much to my surprise. I thought it was going to kind of disappear as I breathed with it and stay there, but it got worse. And then I also noticed that eventually there was a lot of commentary coming back to me like, oh, yeah, this has really been bugging me the whole day, and, you know, now it's really bugging me, and with me got worse. Couldn't make it get better.
So it's very interesting to kind of be present for all that and see it all that. There's a lot to discover. One is that there are three basic possibilities of what might happen when you pay attention to something in your body. It gets weaker, it gets stronger, and it stays the same. And it's not your job to have a preference. Your job is to be present for how it actually is, what happens to it. And you don't know what needs to happen. Of course, what we want to happen is to go from discomfort to comfort. We're such strong creatures wanting comfort or pleasure or avoiding displeasure. But the inner process is not one that we necessarily should be in control of in deciding what should happen. So for example, chronically tense muscles go numb. And as we wait, and numb means there's no awareness there. As we become more embodied and become more aware to that part of our body, and then we start feeling that tension, that clenching. As we become aware of that clenching, no longer numb, we discover that clenching hurts. So in the process of beginning to soften and relax, sometimes actually it hurts more and more as we can begin to unclench. So what's better? To notice that you're hurt and you're clenched, and then go back to being numb? Or is it better to be patient and allow the process of relaxation that might entail hurting more before it hurts less? Which is better? I hope you think the latter is better. You're all silent. I don't know if that was your case, but if that's the, So you don't necessarily know what's being worked through you. You need to pay some attention. If the pain is one that is structural and you're ripping your cartilage in your knee, please change your posture. But you can pay attention, And also the other thing, so that's one thing. Maybe there's an inner process of releasing the tension that needs to happen that can only happen best if you're attentive to it. It's kind of, I think of attention as kind of like creating a room where something can begin to unwind. And so it creates a space for something to happen if we hold it in attention. The other thing that happens is that we're also, this is very important, is we're developing the capacity to be present for uncomfortable things without being reactive, without being caught up in the commentary. And this here is like a laboratory or gymnasium where we're learning that skill. And so when we do meditate, some people will choose to meditate with the discomfort they have in meditation so they can learn to be freer of discomfort. And we say in Buddhism that if you're only free when you're comfortable, you're not really free. So you have to learn, you have to have the capacity to be with something that's uncomfortable and not be pushed around by it or caught by it or reactive to it. And it's a great training to do that when things are uncomfortable. And here you might have some choice. Perhaps you could move your posture or something. But sooner or later in your life, you're not going to have a choice. You're going to come to a situation where it's very uncomfortable and you can't get out of it easily. And because you're familiar with the territory of discomfort and how your mind reacts and your beliefs and emotions and all that goes on, you go, oh, that's what my mind does. Look at that. I don't have to buy into it. I don't have to be caught by it. So there's two things that can happen. You can work through it. You can allow some inner process to unfold and work through. And you learn, and maybe more important, is you learn that capacity to be equanimous and balanced in relationship to it. Make sense? So the fact that it was stronger for you and it faded for her, that's fine. Both of you are right.
when you're experiencing, say, you feel that tension. When you're experiencing that feeling of discomfort or numbness, and is it okay to, in your mind, say, release, you know, unsoften?
Sure.
You know, take some positive action to it. I mean,
yes,
if you feel that positive mind action, you know, warm, just to warm up that muscle or
sure.
And then relieve that pain.
It's fine. You know, it's fine, and it's an obvious thing to do. But you want to be a little bit careful that you don't make a habit of that, and you always feel like you have to fix it and change it and make it better. If it's easy to do, please do it. Sooner or later, it won't be that easy. And then don't get involved in engineering it and trying to fix it and judging yourself. You can't do it. You can't make anything happen. And sooner or later, when you do this practice, if there's something uncomfortable, you have to learn how to be present for the discomfort without it being fixed. And so don't fall into the trap of thinking you're always supposed to be fixing it. Yes, up here. You can pass the mic up there.
I had the experience of first being with the discomfort and then zoning out. And when I became aware again, my body was kind of swaying very gently back and forth. Not because I told it to, but that's somehow what my body wanted to do. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I think you're being mindful. That's great. You notice what happened to you. What happens to you? You notice you zoned out. You notice that you were swaying. That's the practice. And notice how all this works, and so how you work. And as you do this practice further, you'll understand more and more the details or subtlety of how you actually operate, what actually goes on with you. At some point, you might understand why you zoned out, and it might be very interesting to see. There's actually, you know, there might be a very clear kind of reactivity, a shutting down, a resistance, a fear that comes up that causes the mind to shut down. You might see that the swaying maybe is a very subtle way of comforting yourself in an uncomfortable situation. So you start seeing. So you don't have to go looking, you know, study this stuff, but as you're mindful like you were and keep doing it over time, you start to get more and more familiar with the territory of what goes on with you, and you'll start seeing more and more. And as you understand yourself better and better, you'll have more choice and freedom in regard to what goes on. So, yeah, you.
Thank you.
So maybe a back, okay, here.
This is more about mindfulness. Oh, sorry, someone else?
Please.
This is more about mindfulness of breath.
Yes.
I find that just trying to use the words in and out to keep myself focused on my breath isn't enough. And so I started doing something like visualizing waves on a beach or something like that to keep my mind focused.
Yes.
Is that appropriate?
If you do it for like a minute or two at the beginning of a sitting, some people have strong visual abilities, can use that to kind of get yourself gathered and centered. It's fine to do a little bit. But we don't want to do a lot of it in meditation, in our meditation system. Other meditations will use it. But the reason we don't use a lot of it is that what we're trying to do in mindfulness meditation is to train ourselves to see clearly what's going on in and of itself. And a visualization is a step removed from the experience. It's kind of like an overlay over the experience. It's kind of like an abstraction. It's not really what's going on. Like so many, I remember some years ago, somebody said, oh, he's feeling, he had strong feelings in his shoulder. I asked him, what are you feeling? I feel like there's heavy football pads on my shoulder. There weren't any football pads on his shoulder. It was an abstraction. What he was feeling was a lot of heaviness and tightness. So the direct experience was heaviness and tightness, not football pads. And so your experience of the breath is not waves washing up and down on the shore. And so if you stay with those experiences of the waves going up and down the shore, you might stay more present. It's more keeps you connected. But it also keeps you removed from the direct experience. It's also using a little bit of a prop or crutch. And ultimately, what's much more interesting is to not to kind of be in a hurry to get concentrated, but to notice what it's like to have a distracted mind. oh, look at that. This is my distracted mind. It's like this. I can follow 3 breaths, 5 breaths, and then it goes away. That's interesting. Let me go back now. Oh, that was now only 2 breaths. That's interesting. Oh, look at that. I'm really concerned about this conversation I had earlier today, and I'm anxious about it. If I really acknowledge the anxiety, then maybe it's easy. Then I can stay with more breaths. I can stay more present. So it's a process of noticing and realizing what's there, as opposed to trying to bypass it to get calm because you think getting calm and concentrated is the purpose. Make sense?
Yeah, that does. But it also, one more thing, it also implies sort of a sequential train of thought, like you're thinking about your breath and then you stop thinking about it. But I find that like my mind is so jumbled that I'm thinking about my breath and thinking about other things at the same time. So
then you become mindful, then you become aware of what it's like to have a jumbled mind. Step back, oh, this is a jumbled mind. It's completely confused and chaotic and out of control. And wow, this is amazing. You know, it's kind of like, wow, you know, I could solve the energy problems of the planet if they just plugged into my brain.
Feels that way.
Yeah, and so it's good to be amazed. It's much better to be amazed than to be disturbed by all of this. And this will make more sense in the next few weeks. In 2 weeks from now, I'll talk about mindfulness of thinking, and that'll give you a better understanding of how to bring more attention to all this. But right now, I want to keep it simple, just breath and body. Come back to the breath, come back to the body. Make some sense so far? Okay, I'd like to do a little exercise with you. Maybe afterwards, like you can stay, I'll stay behind, you can ask. But I'd like to do one more thing here in the time we have left. If you could, you don't have to get into meditation posture if you don't want to, but we're going to close your eyes. And then bring your awareness into your right hand. Become aware of your right hand. The palm of the hand, the fingers, the back of the hand, become aware of a heightened sensitivity to the sensations of your hand. Tingling, pressure, vibration, warmth, coolness, heaviness, lightness. Tightness, looseness. Be very simple, but really explore, feel it. And notice, perhaps, how many sensations, how much sensations are kind of available as you bring more attention to your hand. Becomes more alive, more vibrant, perhaps, fuller experience. Certainly fuller than maybe your left hand. So then, mindfully, deliberately and calmly, bring your attention into your left hand, letting go of the right. And bring a heightened sensitivity to the sensations of your left hand. And then bring your attention to the place in your body where you feel your breathing most clearly, to that location in your body. And in that place in your body, do the same thing. Bring more greater awareness, sensitivity to the sensations and experiences there. vibration, the energy, the warmth, the coolness, tightness, looseness, heaviness, lightness, movement. Allow it to become more sensitive and aware. So you're not thinking about the breathing, but you're really having a heightened sensitivity, awareness to that experience. That world of sensations that you have is not a world of thinking. You might have thoughts about it, but that direct experience of sensation is something much more direct and immediate than any thinking you can have about it. Bring your attention to the area around your ears, your eardrums. Heighten sensitivity, heighten awareness to that area of your body. And allow yourself to become aware of what it's like to receive sounds, sound waves. Doesn't matter what the sound is, sound of my voice, cars, coughing. Be very simple. No need to label it or recognize what it is even. But just feel the experience of listening, sound. And then come back to your breathing and take a couple of deep breaths and then when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So to be mindful is not only to be mentally aware of what's going on, notice what's going on, but it also involves the bodyfulness, the sensing more fully what the experience is. And we start having a different relationship to our experience when we're sensing it more fully in directness of what it is. One of the very interesting is not only do we can see the difference between the commentary and the experience, we can also see the difference between the concept we have and the direct experience. The concept is much simpler than a commentary. So for example, a classic one is if you have pain. Pain is actually a concept. It's not actually a thing. It's pain recognized by physiologists now to be a composite event that involves something like a dozen different component parts come together to create the experience of pain. If you remove some of those component parts, we won't have pain. And some of those component parts are mental, our reactions, interpretations, our ideas about it, and some of them have to do with other things. And if But if you experience pain through the filter of saying pain, there's all these associations with that concept and idea. Oh, you know, it's, you know, it pulls in, it's like a magnet for fear, anxiety, or judgments, all kinds of things. But if you don't see the experience, the strong sensation you have as pain, but see it as tightness and pulling and heat and all these things, it becomes a different relationship to it. It's not as tense. It's not as, you know, we're not seeing it through the filter of a concept. It's like you know, if you see yourself through the filter of being a good meditator or a bad meditator, that's a concept. If you see yourself simply as, oh, here's someone who can follow two breaths, the mind goes on to the thoughts, and you come back. Three breaths, the mind goes into thought, you notice, you come back. That's much simpler and more relaxing than judgment, oh, I'm a bad meditator. So what we're trying to do when we go into the world of sensations is to begin teasing apart the concepts that we add on top of our experience. It isn't that concepts are bad and we shouldn't have them, but if we want to separate them out so we can have more choice and not be fooled by it and see that they're two different things. And this is really helpful in many areas of life. We train ourselves in this way in meditation, but then it translates into our, for example, our social relationship to other people. You see someone else and you say, you know, you're a bad person. Not a bad person, just, you know, maybe it's a person who happens to be grouchy that day. That's maybe okay, you know, if someone's having, you know, and it's a lot easier to see someone who's kind of in a bad mood, that's an irritated mood, as opposed to you're a bad person. So I don't know if that was the best example, but we put these labels on people, and what we train ourselves to do is to see, oh, that's a label. Let's find out who the person really is. Because we see that difference, we separate out. So entering into the world of, it's so simple in meditation, I mean, it's simple to talk about, not easy, simple to do. But the idea is, if we train ourselves to learn to be present for the immediacy of our experience, there's a lot of learning that happens, and it translates into the rest of our life a lot. So it's really worthwhile to do this training and enter into it. It's also an avenue to learn how to become calmer and more settled, because a lot of the stress we have and agitation we have belongs to that world of commentary and concepts and ideas. And as we learn to put that aside, we can taste very deep experience of peace. So when you sit and meditate, at this point, keep your attention on your breathing until some compelling sensation in your body becomes more compelling in your breath. Let go of the breath and bring that careful attention, heightened sensitivity to that part of your body, and experiment and explore and be present for it in a very simple, relaxed way. Don't make it complicated what you're doing. Just bring attention to it. If it's no longer compelling, come back to your breathing. If something else becomes more compelling in the meantime, then let go of the first compelling thing and go to the next compelling thing. And you can, you know, and you don't have to be with the breath at all during a whole session of meditation if your body is so loud. It keeps you busy the whole time. That's fine. Just be present for this and this in the body. And part of what the kind of this bodily experience is sounds. So if you hear loud sounds that are more compelling than your breathing or anything else, then we do a listening meditation. And that's a lot better than judging the sounds as being a distraction to my meditation. So if you're meditating and your neighbor's dog barking, you could say, boy, you know, if only they weren't barking, then I could meditate. You know, how could they? You know, one more time, and it's so unjust, and the world's unjust, and barking dogs, and, you know, and the dog's distracting me. Dog's not distracting me. You're distracting yourself with all your judgments and ideas. That's the distraction. And what we do is, in this meditation, we don't consider the dog barking a distraction. We do the meditation, the barking meditation. And that is, we just okay, that's what's compelling. Let's be present for that. Let's learn what it's like to be there. Let's find out if I can just be present for that without reactions and judgments. Just do sound. And until when it's no longer compelling, then we come back. And there's a lot of learning, a lot goes on. It's much more relaxing. It's much more relaxing just take everything that's going on as the meditation, as opposed to that keeping that at bay, I can't do that. Make sense? And so so for now, keep it simple enough between breath, body, and sounds. And if anything else, just let go of it and come back. Next week, we're going to talk about mindfulness of emotions. Hugely important part. But for next week, please don't have any emotions. They'll just get in the way. Those of you who are precocious, you know, or insist on having emotions, well, you know, just be patient till next week. What's really great is that the more you learn how to be present for your body, the easier it is to practice mindfulness of emotions. So rather than the emotions, the body taking you away, and kind of like, you know, actually the emotions is really, the body is really a foundation for a healthy relationship to our emotions and be able to work with it. So really for this next week, try to just be in your body as much as you can, be interested in your body, check into your body. If you're waiting for a red light, waiting for something, anytime you're waiting for anything at all, use that as an opportunity to check into your body. What's going on here? What's happening here? Be aware of what's going on in your body. Make it a habit of checking in and finding out. There's a lot that can happen with you. Get more familiar with your body. There is a handout that has some of this instructions that I gave today for your review to read at home. It also has some mindfulness of the body exercises you can do during the week. And also, I have a book called The Issue at Hand, which here at IMC we distribute freely. And it has some essays, and some of these essays cover some of these areas and different aspects of this mindfulness practice. And you might want to pick up a copy. It's by the door and somewhere else here. It's a blue cover. You're welcome to take it and maybe augment your practice during the week. So thank you very much. And those of you who have questions and you have a chance to ask, I'll be up here. Please come up. Thank you.